Chapter 7. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Part 1. These words sound as if they might come straight from the heart of modern man, and this was strongly in evidence, especially during the years of the Second World War. At that time, millions of human beings were craving after righteousness. Within a period of 5 years, hunger and thirst for righteousness had risen to fever heat. This hunger gnawed at the nerves and hearts of the battered and tormented people, as the lack of food ate into the flesh of human bodies. Many of you, too, dreamed your dreams of righteousness, and in your conversations, you discussed for hours on end the manner in which, to your mind, righteousness should be attained. In your world of fancies, you took part in administering justice, and meanwhile, you enjoyed serving the summons. Yes, indeed, at that time, everyone decidedly did hunger and thirst for righteousness. But after that yearning for righteousness had been more or less appeased, did blessedness come to people? To you? That blessedness which is a state of the highest spiritual felicity? Undeniably, one was hungering and thirsting for righteousness, but we ask you, did one also have this great hunger and thirst prior to the great world conflagration, at the time when you were still basking in your high standards of living, and it could be said that you did not want for anything? At the time when the unemployed, the paupers of that time, could still live in material luxury as compared to the situation during the last years of the war? Did you then also lie awake because of your hunger for righteousness? At that time, were you feeling that same profound indignation about the injustice in this world? Was the world's woe stirring in you? Or wasn't it rather that most of you were totally engrossed in your bourgeois liberal quietude? Didn't you think that those people who bothered about righteousness were foolish agitators? Did you ever lose 1 second of sleep or feel moved for 1 instant because so many others hungered for righteousness? Didn't you meet the struggle for righteousness with icy indifference or a polite, very cultured, carefully studied but empty and deceitful sympathy, a pretense that left your heart totally unmoved? Has it ever come home to you that the causes of the present must be traced back to the past? And because you did not trouble yourself about righteousness in the past, because up to that moment, injustice had passed your door, you do not have the least right to talk about justice. Has your mind ever opened to the idea that you have done more than your share in unleashing the unrighteousness, both then and now, and that you are co-responsible for it? Together with the great majority of others, you have for years on end held yourself strictly aloof from justice in this world and considered those who demanded it as mischief makers or crazy idealists. Without pronouncing too severe a judgment, the least that can be said is that there is something amiss with that strong urge for righteousness in countless people, and that it bears a tinge of egotism. Your eye was being cornered. Your eye was under attack, hence your desire for justice. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Many of you are firmly convinced that your yearning for righteousness has already existed for a long time. We will try to shake this conviction. Try to examine yourself psychoanalytically. In by far the majority of cases, you will then discover that your urge for righteousness is the consequence of personally suffered injustice which you were unable to overcome. It is a fact that personal experience in life usually contributes to the formation of our consciousness. But in these things, experience is by no means always the best teacher. Social upsets, difficulties in our intimate relations, physical handicaps or other circumstances which have attacked the supposed kingship of our I can create a certain urge for justice. Our personal situation sometimes offers a concept of justice that opens perspectives for the satisfaction of our own shaken mind and heart. A person's affinity for one or another spiritual movement can very often be traced to a primary frustration suffered by the I. If the I then experiences a new disappointment within that spiritual movement, interest flags, the expectation of justice drains from the consciousness and can no longer be retained in the blood. The idea becomes a hindrance, so the I goes in search of other associations. Can you see that in all such instances, it is not hunger and thirst for righteousness that was uppermost, but rather I gratification? When such gratification fails to come, then the devil can take the whole idea, the exponents of the idea along with it. One beats a retreat, not in a straightforward, sincere way, but quite in line with the motive, viewed psychologically. King I in rags goes his way with much outward show and a great deal of bumptiousness, and his exit leaves no regret. Without pronouncing an all too severe judgment, the least that can be said in this instance also is that there was something wrong with the strong urge for righteousness, as the desired eye gratification failed to come. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Many persons are firmly convinced that the yearning for righteousness was already felt for a long time. In applying to themselves the psychoanalytical method we recommended, they could not find any eye frustration. The state of their consciousness is caused by a rational moral instinct of justice. But we ask you, what can we do with an instinct of justice in a world which is a broken reality? Which justice is real justice? Is it not true that what one man declares to be the highest form of justice is considered by another to be the greatest injustice? Isn't justice being twisted into all sorts of contortions? And then again, the eye emerges, even though it may not be your own eye that plays the foremost part. There are those who have an interest in a certain form of justice in the world. Their elves have climbed on the bandwagon, with others approving this form of justice. Because of the fact that this very same justice has brought about the ruin of others, a struggle for justice takes place. The justice of opposing interests was the justice that brought one to the top, not human justice. And is not the justice of someone else also human justice? This, in fact, is dialectics. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. We said that there are people in whom there is an inborn instinct of rational moral righteousness. Is this the righteousness that renders one blessed? We are all born of the blood potential of our parents, which commonly means, as the old cock crows, the young cock learns. Thus we possess the instincts of righteousness as inherited from our ancestors, because we are from this nature and of this nature. In all this urge for righteousness, there is undoubtedly a certain culture, but it is a culture that leads to a crisis which will turn into its opposite. Here again, we run up against dialectics with which man has been so infatuated throughout the ages. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Anyone who investigates these things will come to the conclusion that hunger and thirst for righteousness, as seen in the light of the nature of this world, are not liberating in any of their aspects and cannot be separated from the delusions of the eye, to say nothing of blessedness. Here we must repeat, for the nth time, that the Beatitudes are designed for entities of a spiritual stature different to those who are of this world. True divine justice can only be comprehended when a human being can see into the divine plan for world and mankind, when he has a first-hand sense of the original state of the human life wave. When this higher reality casts its light into his consciousness and he is awakened from his ignorance, the logical result will be an intense hunger and thirst for this righteousness. After all is said and done, hunger and thirst are not desires, but bodily needs which are experienced. They are needs which, if not satisfied, result in destruction. Thus we find a human being who is enlightened in absolute truth and in absolute justice, a being who sees deeply into the divine, all but who finds himself in a counter nature, in a world which is, to its very marrow, exactly the opposite of its divine component. Therefore, this human being, exalted in God and participant of the divine life, will quite naturally hunger and thirst in this world, because here he cannot satisfy his most elementary needs with respect to his spirit, soul, and body. He cannot bear it. It is an impossible task. Two such lives cannot be lived at the same time, and yet help is offered. He who hungers and thirsts in this way is satisfied. In this beatitude, no perspective is presented for an ultimate golden future in which the divine plan for world and mankind will be restored to its original glory. If he who hungers and thirsts had to wait for this, the perspective would offer him but an utterly poor consolation. No, a man who stands in such a vital need receives satisfaction directly and immediately. Certain forces and attributes, great joy and an intense love, are given to him as absolute realities. Satisfied in this way, this man is able to carry on and live in his place of service, as a worker in the great working place for world and mankind. This affluence of attributes and forces maintains the pupil in a state of the highest felicity and true blessedness. This is another instance of experiencing eternity in time. In this dialectical world, one is happy only when one's object has been attained. In the static world, one is already blessed in pursuing the great aim. Pursuing the aim is already victory in itself. It is eternity manifested in time. It may be difficult to realize the grandeur of these things. Here, we can understand one another only to the spirit. Did you ever, in the midst of the most complicated situations, experience the immediate presence, as the ancients called it? This immediate presence appeases your hunger and quenches your thirst out of God's hand and lifts you up beyond space and time, though you are immersed in space and time. Why should we hunger and strive for righteousness to be established according to the precepts of this nature? Such righteousness is a fata morgana, a chimera, a phantasm. Such righteousness does not exist. Does it in fact not exist? It does not, because all injustice and all speculation about justice results from ignorance, from transgression of the elementary laws of life, from the delusion of the eye and from our collective madness, all of which makes us take this world of delusion wherein nothing is lasting and nothing is real for reality, while we are left completely blind and ignorant with respect to our original domain of life, the world of the universal spirit. Merely striving for earthly righteousness is unintelligent. If you run into a ditch, though you are able to see and have brains with which to think, and you possess free choice with regard to your direction, does it make sense, or is it justice, to either fill up the ditch or to build a bridge over it, or to put a watchman there? If that particular channel were filled up, you would only fall into the next one. If a bridge were built, you would step off that one too. If there were a watchman, you would disregard him. It is when you are in misery that you cry for justice, while in the past you have ignored the causes of your misery. Hasn't it always been that way? You know, ask for laws and regulations that are supposed to spare you future miseries, but if these laws do not exist within yourself, then you can never look to a future righteousness apart from the constant rhythm of rising, shining, and fading. We ask you this: is it a deed of love to establish an order of life which is in balance with our ignorance, our stupidity, and our madness? Or rather, would it be a deed of love to let you come, time and again, to a dead end within yourself, in order to make you realize that a different kind of possession should be brought into our lives? Isn't it a deed of love to speak to you time and again of another righteousness, which is not of this world? A righteousness which, if you should come to hunger and thirst for it, would immediately cause you to be filled with blessedness. The work to be accomplished is to give man spiritual insight and to arouse him to true self-authority. Modem man is a distorted caricature of his original state of being, and he must be transformed into the true man of whom the angelic choir sang, "On earth peace unto all men well-pleasing to him." Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Now, how can we arrive at this new vital need to understand this righteousness and this satisfaction? It is by walking the path of liberation, the path of transmutation and transfiguration. The spiritual school addresses itself mainly to the human type in this world. We call the Cain type. As you know, Cain is a contrast to Abel. The concept of Cain points to possession. Cain is the possessor, and he stands opposite to Abel. Abel points to semblance. He is the man who indulges in appearances and stops at that, who very mystically adores the spiritual light and makes his oblations to it, but who does not let the light work within him for regeneration. This is why Cain is opposed to Abel, and why Cain must destroy the semblance and transform it unto life. If Cain does this according to nature, he is a murderer, a destroyer. But if he does it according to the spirit, he is a victor and a transformer of the world. The spiritual school approaches the Cain type, the possessor. This means it approaches those who, even if in a rudimentary way, possess something of the original knowledge and the original state of being of the divine order. Something of that which is past is still awake in such people, and it drives them to activity, without them being able to handle the keys. The true book of life is still closed to them, sealed with seven seals. The Cain of this nature is a possessor who does not know what to do with his possession. It is to him that the spiritual school comes with its methodical process. It places him under the law of the spirit that gives expression to system and order. In so doing, the school appeals to the pupil's chaotic possession. Thus, the dormant faculties and talents in him are systematically freed under the law, until the pupil is able to become a law unto himself. Then the cane man can live and work out of his possession. Then the prodigal son regains the original land of light. Then he hungers and thirsts for righteousness and is satisfied from the eternal fountainhead of all things. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied.